delighted today to welcome Rufus King International Baccalaureate High School students. Would they stand? Welcome.
Great.
You may be seated.
Both of my children are alma maters of that school.
I didn't know that, Justice Butler. Good. We are supposed to have some Richland Center High School students. Are they here? Well, they may come later or not come. The students are here with us with a program, a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program invites students from all around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. The students have received copies of the briefs and the case they are about to hear. And they may have done several activities in connection with this case. And then at the end of our two arguments in the morning, the students meet with a justice. The justice discusses with the students the procedures the court uses. There is not a discussion of the substantive merits of the particular case. Now, we've met you, so I'd like to introduce the court, and I'm going to start on my far right with Justice Patience Robinsack, and she is the justice with whom the students will meet right after the second case, right here in the courtroom. And seated next to Justice Robinsack is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler, who is not a graduate himself of Rufus King, but his children are a graduate. Justice Butler hails from Chicago. With those introductions and miscellaneous information, not particularly relevant, we'll call our first case. 03-1698 CR State versus Timothy S.B. Smith. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General James M. Frymuth. Mr. Frymuth.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as petitioner in this criminal case. The Court of Appeals has reversed defendant Timothy Smith Sr.'s two felony convictions of failure to pay child support, and it also has concluded that double jeopardy bars retrial. The state asks this court to either reinstate Mr. Smith's convictions or to order a new trial. Two issues of statutory construction are presented, and the state offers alternative arguments on both of them as follows. On the first question, on the meaning of and the application of competent jurisdiction in the definition of child support, the state asks this court to hold as follows, and there are four, actually, alternative ways this could proceed. The first position of the state is that the legislature intended competent jurisdiction to mean subject matter jurisdiction, and that when raised by a defendant, it is to be determined by the trial court. The trial court properly resolved it in this case. The second and alternative position is that the legislature at most intended competent jurisdiction to present a jury question only when there is a genuine dispute of material fact as to jurisdiction, subject matter, or personal jurisdiction. In this case, the state asked the court to hold that there was no such genuine dispute of material fact. The third alternative is, even if competent jurisdiction is always a jury issue, failure to instruct on it in this case was harmless error, again, because there was no genuine dispute of fact on the question of jurisdiction. And finally, if instructional error occurred that was not harmless error, the proper remedy should be a new trial, not a dismissal with prejudice. Double jeopardy does not bar retrial because sufficient evidence was adduced that the main superior court that issued the child support order had jurisdiction to do so, subject matter and personal jurisdiction. On the second question, the question of the admissibility of Exhibit 3, which was a copy of a certified copy of the child support order, the state asked this court to hold as follows. And I have four points on that one.
Do they mix and match?
I'm sorry?
Do they mix and match?
I hope so.
Okay.
And it's complicated. This is an unusual case in the way that, normally you have what the legislature intended, and if there was error, harmless error. But here we have also the remedy issue. We have potential different ways of the legislative intent.
Right.
And the second question is an evidentiary question, but also a question of statutory interpretation. On this question, the state asked the court to hold as follows. First, that the federal full faith and credit statute, that's 28 U.S.C. 1738 and 1738B, does not set forth the exclusive method for admitting foreign court documents. And on that particular point, the Court of Appeals agrees with the state and made that conclusion. Secondly, in this case, the certified copy of the child support order, which was not formally introduced, if it had been, would have been admissible under either Section 909.02 or Section 889.15, which is the section that the Court of Appeals said is the only applicable section, but yet it didn't. It concluded that the document didn't satisfy that statute.
This is a minor point, but I wanted, since you're on that,
sure.
Now to properly authenticate a document or certified, the Greene County, clerk was basically not the custodian. So this is the argument that your opponent makes. To have that properly certified, the custodian of the document, I assume they mean the original custodian, the custodian in Maine, would have been the custodian of the document?
That's correct. The original document, of course.
Mean, just as a practical matter, that person would have to certify it and be available to testify? Is that what they're...
No, I don't believe so. The certified copy is self-authenticating if certain requirements are met.
All right. But one of the requirements they wanted was that clerk, the clerk in Maine, should be the person, not the clerk in Greene County.
The Court of Appeals concluded that the Greene County clerk couldn't authenticate
right.
the original because she wasn't the clerk in Maine. She did not have the original. What she had was a certified copy sent from Maine. That certified copy was in the ERISA file for the child support. Then what they did at trial was, instead of putting that in, they introduced, this is where I misread the record, they introduced a copy of that certified copy.
But under ERISA, which is set up so that this does not become overwhelmingly complicated or expensive, ordinarily that document would be accepted as valid, correct?
If it meets the requirements of the self-authenticating
mm-hmm.
process.
The certified copy of the main document was in the clerk's office, is that right?
It was in the ERISA file, right, in Greene County clerk's office.
And that would probably be next door to the courtroom?
It was actually brought into the courtroom, as I reread the record, that the county clerk in Greene County testified at trial. She had with her the ERISA file. She was asked to identify the certified copy of the Maine court order that had been sent from Maine. She did that. And then instead of putting that document in, as I understand it, what happened was they had a duplicate made of the certified copy, and that's what actually got in as the exhibit.
Did the defense agree to that?
The defense didn't challenge that.
And
the defense did not object to that particular component of the document. The defense challenged the certified copy, the one that didn't get in, that was in the file. And on the ground that it did not have a judicial certificate saying that the attestation was true and correct. The clerk's attestation was there, but not the judicial certificate.
Mr. Frymuth, would you go ahead and give us your last two points before
sure.
we lose track of that, please?
Sure. The second point was that the certified copy would have been admissible if introduced. The third point deals with this duplicate copy, and that is that this court should hold that the duplicate copy of the certified copy was properly admitted, and there are two statutes involved here under two statutes, 909.015 and sub 1 and 7 of that statute, and then 910.03. And I say that also adding a point here that was just brought up by Justice Butler, and that is especially since Mr. Smith did not object to the duplicate nature of the document that was introduced. Finally, even if the copy of the certified copy was inadmissible, Smith's own testimony proved the contents of the child support order in accordance with Section 910.05 and a statute that I did not recognize until this week, and in fairness to Mr. Donnelly, it's not in the brief, but it's 910.07, which I think more specifically deals with admitting testimony of an adverse party. The contents of that can be introduced through an adverse party if they admit that, even without the document itself. And I apologize, I did not discover that until preparing for argument. Again, in fairness to opposing counsel, that's not in the brief. And if the court wanted further briefing on that, I'd be more than happy to do so. Turning then to the first issue, the issue of competent jurisdiction in the definition of child support. Mr. Smith argued before trial that the Maine Superior Court that issued the child support order lacked authority to do so, that only the district court in Maine that had issued the divorce judgment originally was the court that could act. He also argued before trial that this should go to the jury as a jury question. The trial court disagreed, but the Court of Appeals agreed with him.
Counselor, why is this question before us if he challenged these orders repeatedly, which is what the record says, and failed on all those challenges? I mean, why isn't that a done deal? That he challenged the court's order in Maine, he failed. Why are we having to deal with any question about whether that order is now a order from a court of competent jurisdiction?
Well, that's the conclusion the state would ask the court to draw, but the threshold question, I believe, is one of legislative intent, and that is whether competent jurisdiction in the definition of child support somehow is an element for the jury to determine, whether a separate element or part of one of the existing three elements, in particular the first element that requires the state to prove that the defendant violated a child support order.
Thank you.
Several questions arise with respect to this. One, of course, is the meaning of competent jurisdiction, but the more critical question here is really what the legislature intended and whether it intended it for the jury or not.
Well, isn't your first point that it's not even an element of the offense?
That's correct. The state's primary position here is that competent jurisdiction is purely in the definitional section. It's not what the legislature intended to go to the jury, that it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, which typically is a question of law, pure question of law, at least where there's no dispute that this was the court that acted. This was the order that court issued. Mr. Smith is the person named in the order to pay child support. There are no underlying disputes of fact. The only dispute, and I realize fact and law sometimes runs together, but in this case, the only dispute was this legal dispute. Did this court have authority to act the way it did?
Just assume for sake of argument that we agree with your position that initially this is not an element of the offense, but also assume for sake of argument that the defense has evidence that would challenge the competency of the earlier court to proceed. Could we not treat this in the manner similarly handled in Mose versus State, where the defendant would have the burden of raising a challenge, and then once raising the challenge, the state would then have to disprove it?
If I understand you, you're suggesting an affirmative defense type approach to it. I think this fits into the state's second argument more, and that is that this could have been intended to be a situation like territorial jurisdiction, which is a case the Court of Appeals handled, Brown, and I was counsel in that case, where only where there's a material dispute, genuine material dispute of fact, that then it becomes a jury question. And it only becomes a genuine dispute of fact when the defendant raises it. And in that situation, I suppose if the legislature intended this for the jury to make that determination, that would be one way to do it. But I think that fits into the state's second argument rather than into the first argument.
And where do we find the legislative intent?
Well, there isn't much out there.
What are other states doing?
Other states? I couldn't find any state, any court, that uses competent jurisdiction in a way that says one way or the other whether it's an element of a crime. I think in the reply brief I noted that in Wisconsin, competent jurisdiction appears something like 53 times. It's never been defined.
53 times where?
Throughout the statutes. Mm-hmm. Throughout the statutes. I take back what I just said. In the reply brief, I also cited a California case. And again, I apologize. I'm finding things belatedly in this process, and out of fairness to the other side, again, if you want further briefing, the case is Flora, and it's cited in the reply brief. That was a case where the California Court of Appeals was dealing with this question, and it was a Washington court order, if I remember, in a California case. And the California Court of Appeals, even though it concluded that this was, that competent jurisdiction meant both subject matter and personal jurisdiction, that it was purely for the court to decide as a predicate matter, that it wasn't for the jury. But there isn't an elaborate discussion in that case of how it reached that conclusion.
Well, what makes this flow better or easier? I mean, you assume that the legislature intended to produce a workable statute.
Sure.
So how would you see it working if you should prevail? You see before trial a motion? Is that how you see it? And who has the burden?
The defendant has to raise the burden to challenge that.
That's the question.
Right.
Okay, and then the state's burden is to show competent jurisdiction.
I would guess so. I think that's probably
judgment.
How it would work. Right.
Okay, and then once that's decided by the court, if the court says no, that may be the end of the case.
Correct.
If the court says yes, then you go to trial. And the judge is then the jury is then instructed that there is a valid support order from a Maine court. Is that how you see it?
It could. In fact, there's a judicial notice statute, 902.02, that says that foreign state laws and cases, and in particular 902.02 sub 1 says every court of this state shall take judicial notice of the common law and statutes of every other state. And then sub 3 says the determination of such laws shall be made by the court and not by the jury. That's not to say that the legislature couldn't make it an element, but I would suggest that it's further evidence of the legislative intent that in this situation it would not go to the jury once the court made that determination.
And you wouldn't even have to instruct the jury about anything. It's just it dissipates.
Right. The court, you could have an instruction that's like, if this court had concluded that the legislature wanted this to be a jury question, I guess the way it would proceed would be the court could take judicial notice of the laws of the other state, or it could say the court has, could tell the jury the court has taken judicial notice of the laws of the state of Maine, that this is a court order that I'm not sure exactly that is valid. But still leave it up to the jury. That's not conclusive to the jury, if it were an element. But I'm saying, first of all, that it shouldn't be an element. That's not what was intended.
Mr. Frymuth, can you tell us on what basis the judge here made the determination that the order was entered by a court of competent jurisdiction?
Sure. Unfortunately, there was no discussion about the Maine statutes. It doesn't go that far. What the trial court, best characterization from our standpoint is what the trial court did was to say, Mr. Smith, you admittedly went through the Maine courts. You challenged this in the Maine courts. You didn't get any relief in the Maine courts. Why should I upset what the Maine courts obviously believe is a valid court order? That was the gist, I think, of what the trial court did in this case.
And that information was before the trial court. The circuit court, in other words, had the information concerning the challenge that had been brought by Smith in the Maine courts, and that he had lost that challenge.
That's correct. Smith presented, I believe, before trial to the circuit court here what he had done in the Maine court to challenge it. Then during trial, he also testified to that extent that over a period of 4 years, part of his concern was that he proceeded pro se in Maine, and he was saying that, therefore, I shouldn't bar me now from doing it with an attorney here in this criminal case.
Well, that's, suppose the Maine court said, gee, we have jurisdiction, no problem, you lose, Mr. Defendant. And now you come into Wisconsin. Can an attorney or the party challenge that Maine conclusion, or do you have to give full faith and credit to Maine's decision that it has jurisdiction?
As I understand the application of full faith and credit, there would have to be subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, and no.
You could look at it again.
So you could look at it again, right.
So his decision that Maine said it was okay is not good enough, probably.
Right. Yes, and there's one that deals with collateral attacks. One of the points I'm in support of the proposition that this is for the court and not for the jury is that normally you can't collaterally attack a judgment in a foreign court where a jurisdictional issue has been fully litigated in that court. This is, I'm looking at Hansen versus McAndrews, I believe, at pages 25 and 26 of the state's brief. And in Maine, I cite a case from Maine that stands for the proposition that an aggrieved party's failure to take a direct appeal from a judgment ordering child support renders that judgment immune from collateral attack. Mr. Smith attempted to appeal and then defaulted on the appeal because he refused to pay the filing fees. Then in Hansen versus McAndrews, with respect to that situation, this court said, and I'm quoting, if a jurisdictional issue is fully litigated in the foreign court and is not subject to collateral attack in that state, then the foreign court is bound by the judgment rendered as to jurisdiction as well, meaning Wisconsin's court.
And I would assume that one way of proving competent jurisdiction, subject matter or personal, is to perhaps bring in an expert witness on Maine law.
That's correct. And in this particular case at trial, the defense did present testimony from an adjunct professor at the UW who basically said that he wasn't familiar with the laws of Maine, but that's what would be necessary to determine, fully determine the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, personal, subject matter jurisdiction, at least, of the Maine court.
If it was challengeable.
I'm sorry?
If it was challengeable, but you might take the position no collateral challenge.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, it depends on legislative intent whether it's an element or not, and as I say, here every indication is that it is not an element.
If this question of court of competent jurisdiction were a separate element to be presented to the jury, wouldn't that also apply to cases that were wholly within Wisconsin?
That's correct. If competent jurisdiction of the court that issued the order is an element that has to go to the jury, it wouldn't matter whether it's a foreign state court or another Wisconsin court. This part of the problem with this is, and especially I think with the Court of Appeals decision, is jurisdiction can mean not only subject and personal, but it gets into all the competency to exercise jurisdiction where you could have a variety of other statutory requirements. And so if it's truly an element, so that it doesn't matter if the defendant even challenges it, but the state has to prove it, how do you instruct the jury on all these other, what's supposed to go into the instruction on all the timing had to be right and all these other particular components of jurisdiction? It just seems to me it's rife for instructional error. In a plea colloquy, would the defendant have to be told that the court that issued, you have one of the elements that the state would have to prove is that the court that issued the order had subject matter jurisdiction under this statute, that it had personal jurisdiction that you submitted, that all these other requirements for entry of the order were met in the statutes. It just is a very cumbersome process, and I don't think the legislature intended that.
If we were to affirm this part of the decision of the Court of Appeals, what would be the effect on other cases in the pipeline and in the past?
As far as retroactivity of this decision, I don't think that there hasn't been an analysis done of it, but my position probably would be that it would only apply to cases in the direct appeal pipeline at the time the decision was issued, and that it wouldn't reach back to cases already final, meaning cases that already had passed, or there's no longer a direct appeal available.
Are there many such cases?
I don't know. My guess is that since this decision was issued, that there probably are not. I haven't seen any cases since this decision was issued that have followed up. The closest, and I have a case in a different, similar kind of issue, but a different statute, a different crime, that's the child custody, interference with child custody crime, where there has to be an order for custody. And that case also has a challenge that the the defendant is claiming fraud. But that would be another case where the meaning of the order and whether that is a jury question or not would also be present. So it does have that potential spillover effect. Go ahead.
You indicated that the phrase competent jurisdiction appears quite a number of times in the statute. Wouldn't our decision affirming the Court of Appeals potentially affect a lot of other cases besides child support?
I imagine it could. I think it could be contextual. It could be limited to this question of legislative intent and element of the crime. It wouldn't necessarily, I don't think, have to spill over to mean that in every other situation, competent jurisdiction has the same meaning. But certainly it would be a precedent that could be used to argue that point. At page 5 of my reply brief, I guess I cited 153 references to competent jurisdiction with no express definition of it. As the Court of Appeals noted in its decision, it could be defined in a variety of ways, in at least two ways, subject matter or subject matter and personal jurisdiction.
Why not personal jurisdiction alone?
I don't know.
So it's at least three ways.
Yes, or even more. I mean, as I just was indicating, the competency to exercise jurisdiction could actually throw in additional things.
Yeah. The way we've used competency is different than competent jurisdiction. Competent jurisdiction might include competency. That's what I hear you saying.
That's correct. Because in Wisconsin subject matter jurisdiction, as I understand it, is plenary. Every court has it. The question becomes competency to exercise it based on the particular statutes and authority. One other indicator of legislative intent here, I think, and both parties have cited it, is the statute on violating a foreign protection order. One of the elements of that crime that's actually specified in that violation of that statute is that foreign protection order must be entitled to full faith and credit, or have full faith and credit compliance. So when the legislature wanted that question of subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction to go to the jury to be an element of the crime, the legislature clearly knew how to say so in so many words. The second, and I'll just quickly touch on the other two main arguments on this first point, if I could. The second is the analogy to territorial jurisdiction. That's a situation where only if there are a genuine dispute of material fact should it go to the jury. And the jury instructions, in fact, seems to suggest that when it says that only in the usual case would you need instruction on it, but without any guidance as to what they mean by that. The closest...
Your argument would be that the defendant would first have to raise the issue.
The defendant would first have to raise it, and there would have to be a genuine dispute of material facts underlying that. And in this case, there is no dispute of fact, and even under that scenario.
Assuming we were to go that route, disagree with the proposition that we should apply Moe's and then say the state would have to disprove it once it was raised?
I haven't thought through enough on the affirmative defense burdens to, I guess, that I want to venture a complete answer there. I think it's similar to what is being done with territorial jurisdiction and what I'm suggesting here. But I don't think it completely answers it because of the question of is this an element? I don't have a good answer, I guess, whether I want to accept that. But it sounds like what the territorial jurisdiction analysis would be and what this would be if that was the way the court went. And then to follow on that, to conclude that point, I would suggest that even though the jury wasn't instructed here, there was no genuine dispute of facts, so it wasn't necessary. But even if this court said that it had to be instructed, there would be harmless error because there was no dispute here that the main court had jurisdiction based on Mr. Smith's testimony. He submitted to the court. I'm sorry, my time's up here. I should be stopping. He submitted to the court. He admitted that he went through the courts challenging it. The jury could conclude, if it had been instructed, that there was no subject matter jurisdiction problem or personal jurisdiction problem. Thank you.
But they weren't instructed.
They were not instructed as the defendant requested, right?
Counsel for the defendant, Patrick Donnelly, Assistant State Public Defender.
May it please the Court. My name is Pat Donnelly. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender. Excuse me. and I represent the respondent in this case, Mr. Smith. My position in this case is, hopefully, a little bit more succinct than the petitioner's position is. I'm here to urge this court and to argue to this court that the court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case on every point. In response to some of the comments that have been made thus far, I think I will start at the end rather than at the beginning. As I understand the state's position, there are several alternatives that the way this evidence could come in at trial. One would be, as in my strong position here is, that it should be an element that should be submitted to the jury for jury determination. A second alternative is that it's purely a question of law to be decided by the court. I hear a third alternative, that is that it should be an affirmative defense or perhaps a rebuttable presumption that places the burden upon the defendant to proceed and perhaps shift the burden to the defendant in that case.
Hey, counsel, I want to talk about submitting it to the jury. It just seems to me, and just considering the URISA, considering the complications, just tell me how you anticipate this will go into the jury. What will the jury hear, and will it require expert testimony?
I believe in very rare cases it would require expert testimony. I think in 99% of the cases, which would be prosecutions based on state trial court, circuit court orders, I think in most cases that would result in a stipulation that the order was issued by a court of competent jurisdiction. I think in those cases such as this, I think this is a particularly problematic case. I think this case is an extreme case, quite frankly, and the reason I say that is because I believe there is a legitimate basis and a real issue of fact as to whether or not the court that issued this decision in the state of Maine had the authority to do so. But I think that is very unusual. The way I would see this being submitted to the jury, I think, is very similar to the way a violation of an out-of-state restraining order is submitted to the jury. And, in fact, I think that instruction is a very fine template to begin with in terms of drafting an instruction. I think probably the most difficult task here, and I would admit that this might require more work of the state, would be exploring what the law is in the sister state as it relates to jurisdiction. Now, the state did cite a statute which gives apparently the Superior Court original jurisdiction in the state of Maine the authority to issue decisions and orders in family matters. And it may well be that would be sufficient to instruct the jury on. A jury could be told that competent jurisdiction has the meaning that the Court of Appeals has supplied in this decision. That is, it's a court that has the power to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction and a court that obtained personal jurisdiction over the defendant. When it comes to defining subject matter jurisdiction, it is probably going to be sufficient in a paragraph to explain what subject matter jurisdiction means and explain that it is based upon statutory authority of the court to act, and the state can then argue to the jury what statutory authority they're relying on. And if the defendant has a defense to that, he can certainly argue that to the jury.
Mr. Donnelly, this is a uniform act. Can you point to any other states that require that the issue of whether it's a court of competent jurisdiction in the sending state, that issue must be submitted to a jury?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I would disagree that this prosecution is based upon a uniform act of any sort.
Well, the Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement and Support Act is certainly at the basis for this issue. I understand that it's a criminal charge. I understand it's a charge of non-support. But certainly at the basis of this whole argument is a uniform act. Now, are there other states that submit questions like this in support charges to juries?
With regard to whether or not other states, based upon their own statutes, I'm not aware. I did not look to see whether or not the other states have similar criminal statutes, such as Wisconsin, that require proof of jurisdiction.
Do you think that taking the approach that was suggested by the Court of Appeals and that you're suggesting would complicate the enforcement of this Uniform Act?
It certainly would not complicate the enforcement of the civil aspect of ERISA. I don't believe our statute, 948.22, has anything to do with ERISA. I think that the civil enforcement would proceed just as it always has, and criminal enforcement of this particular statute, which I think has existed the way it has for many years. And the reason is because this is rarely going to be an issue. I don't think this Court's opinion will have any bearing or impact whatsoever on the civil enforcement of child support orders from out of state. Section 769 has its own definition of what a support order is, and it's extensively broader than what the legislature decided to use in criminal prosecutions. I think that is really at the core of what these issues are about. These are wholly separate types of enforcement matters. Justice Robinsack commented on why should we even delve into the question of whether or not the court that issued this decision in the state of Maine had the authority to do so. Well, I would submit that the issue here for a criminal prosecution isn't as complicated as perhaps it seems. One, I would think before we incarcerate someone, we would do so based upon an ultimate conclusion that the document that's being relied on is a valid document. That is, that it is what it purports to be, that it's authentic and it has been authenticated within the rules that this Court has established in the rules of evidence. Secondly, I think it would be at our peril that we would incarcerate someone in the state of Wisconsin based on an order that is perhaps unenforceable in the sister state.
Hadn't that been determined by the sister state?
Right.
The only court that ruled on the merits in this issue on this matter was the court that issued the child support order when it issued the order. I believe the testimony was in the evidence that was offered regarding Mr. Smith's appeal in the state of Maine came solely from Mr. Smith. And included in his comments was that the Court of Appeals in Maine never reached the merits of his appeal simply because he was unable to post the filing fees.
But that doesn't make the order that was issued invalid in any way. That's the final order. You don't have to appeal things to have a final order.
Well, if what we're concerned about, well, let me set an example to this.
But just go back to that question. I mean, you don't have to appeal things to have a final order in a case. That's not what makes it final.
I would agree that the order was final, but what the argument is the order was not valid. And we would not, I would hope, be incarcerating individuals based upon an invalid order of the court.
Right. Well, but that goes to what was litigated in the court in Maine. And it was my understanding, though I may be wrong, because I have to say I haven't read everything in the record, that he did litigate, that this court in Maine that was in a different county from where the divorce judgment was entered shouldn't have been entering a child support order. And he lost on that, and he wanted to appeal it, but he didn't want to pay the money that it cost to pay an appeal or submit an affidavit of indigency, so he wouldn't have to pay the fees. So it stopped right there. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, that he did raise the objection in the court that issued the order.
Then I don't know why that's not a final order on that issue.
Well, I with all due respect, Justice Rogensack, I would agree that it's a final order, but what is at issue here is whether or not the legislature, a different body than this body, decided that something more needs to be determined other than just that an order of a court has been issued. They included the language.
So you say it can be a final order, but maybe the court still wasn't a court of competent jurisdiction is what
right.
You want us to decide. Yeah.
Well, by way of example, if by some error a municipal court judge in this state concludes that they have the authority to issue a child support order, issues one, it gets filed with the authority in that particular municipality, it's certified as an order of a municipal court, certainly everybody in a circuit court setting in this state would recognize that's not a valid order, one, for enforcing a child support order, And two, it's certainly not valid for proceeding on a criminal prosecution.
Mr. Donnelly.
I see your point. Thank you.
But I don't. And here's the problem that I have. The element that was argued in the Court of Appeals and the one that the Court of Appeals adopted was a court of competent jurisdiction issued an order requiring the defendant to provide child support. There's no issue of validity in that element. It's whether or not you have a court of competent jurisdiction issuing an order. And isn't that what we have here? Whether it's valid or not is a separate question.
Well, let's assume for sake of argument that the state of Maine has a statute that is drafted exactly on all fours as ours. And somehow a copy of that municipal court order lands in a court in Maine, and they proceed on a criminal prosecution on the basis of an order that could not be enforceable in this state. It would seem to me to be fundamentally unfair and a violation of due process to do that. In this state, if the legislature had intended something less than what they've described in the statute, they could have simply said, they could have described a child support order as an order of a court. Section 769 doesn't even require that. So the question becomes, what did the court mean by jurisdiction, one, and two, what did they mean by competent jurisdiction? And I believe firmly that the Court of Appeals got that absolutely correct. What they meant was the power to exercise subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Donnelly, because this goes to this so-called fourth element that was created. As I read the statute and look at the elements that are described in the jury instruction committee describes three elements, the first element being the defendant intentionally failed to provide child support. The issue of competent jurisdiction is involved in the definition of child support. How do you get a fourth element out of that?
Well, the statute itself, 948, provides the definition of what they mean by child support. I don't think we have to defer to the...
Child support is involved in the first element, according to the instructions committee. Why isn't that definition subsumed within that element?
Well, if we accept the proposition that it is an element, it's similar to the Least case or the Harvey case or U.S. versus Golden, where the jury has to understand what the meaning of a child support order is. In this case, the legislature was very specific. They didn't leave it just a court order. They defined it. And they defined it as an order that was issued by a court of competent jurisdiction.
I don't quite understand why it can't be handled in some sort of a motion hearing to test the legality either of the court or of the order.
Well, when I started my comments here, when I said I started at the end of this, I would like to make clear for the court that under any of those theories, in this particular case, Mr. Smith prevails. But as I read 948.22, the legislature was very specific about what they expected here. If they wanted this to be an affirmative defense, 948.22 includes a subsection that addresses affirmative defenses. And it lists one and says it's not exclusive, but says that an affirmative defense is an inability to pay. I think if the legislature intended this to be an affirmative defense, that would have been the obvious place to put it. And if they had expected something less, they would have used a different definition, such as they used in Chapter 769, for the definition of what a child support order is.
Yeah, a more general question is, in reading a statute, it is not always self-evident to me how many elements there are in any particular statute. Is there some sort of test that you would point to help me figure that out?
I am unaware of any particular statutory or judicial test to determine that. I think it's determined on a case-by-case basis in reading each statute.
And here, the issue of a court of competent jurisdiction is in a definition of a phrase, child support, which phrase child support appears in the statement of the crime. Can you think of any other statute where that occurs and the court has said that is or is not an element? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I guess the only thing that comes to mind is I believe it's a Godin decision that talked about materiality, a material misrepresentation in a document. And materiality was a definition that had to be provided to the jury to determine that element.
I bet there are others that have a definition of what's a child, and then you use that word child in the statute.
Well, of course, the other...
Oh, no, I have to look at it.
The other situation is Harvey, where a park has to be defined. It can't just simply be a park. It has a specific meaning within the statute, just as child support has a specific meaning within this statute.
I just don't remember the statute well enough to know how the structure is, because sometimes when you look at elements, you look at the structure of the statute, right?
Correct.
Right. In the Godin case, it's 18 U.S.C. 1001. That's the one that has the materiality element. Whoever in any matter within the jurisdiction of any department or agency of the United States. The jurisdiction, is that an element?
Within the jurisdiction of the United States?
Whoever in any matter within the jurisdiction of any department or agency of the United States, is that a separate element for a jury?
I don't know if it's a separate element. It certainly it sounds as like it would be part of the very first element that stated that's submitted to the jury.
Well, but I mean, if it's incorporated in something else, as Justice Butler suggested, you want a separate element for the phrase "court of competent," what is it, jurisdiction or whatever the term is. Here is in any matter within the jurisdiction of any department or agency of the United States. Would you be arguing that needs to be phrased separately for a jury finding?
No, I would not argue that. It may well be that what jurisdiction means might have to be defined for the jury.
Mr. Donnelly, why couldn't we handle this in such a manner where if there were a challenge to the competent jurisdiction of the court, the burden of production should be on the defendant to raise the challenge. Once raised, the state would have to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, the only reason I can suggest to this court that would be inappropriate is I believe that this is the wrong forum to do that. I believe if this appears to be problematic to this court or problematic for the state, which I suspect it will not be, the appropriate forum is the Wisconsin State Legislature. And the reason I argue that is because I believe the statute is clear on its face what it means. And to do it otherwise, I think you have to ignore the clear intent of the legislature. And I don't happen to believe this is the appropriate forum to do that.
You don't think it should be switched from an element to an affirmative defense?
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, I just looked at 948.095, which is on the opposite page, and it defines school and school staff, and then it defines the crime. Whoever has sexual contact with a child who's attained the age of 16 is a Class A felony if all the following apply. Child is enrolled as a student in a school. Defendant is a member of the school staff. So you've got to go back to the definitions. Your position is that in that statute, the state would have to prove it's a school.
We have to be convinced.
And the state would have to prove that the person is staff.
Correct.
And the jury would have to be convinced. So this is not an unusual structure for a criminal statute, is all I'm trying to determine.
I couldn't agree more.
Regarding the proof that was offered at trial, Mr. Donnelly, as I understand it, you have a certified copy. You have a certified copy of a Maine order that was brought into court but was not offered as evidence. A copy of the certified copy was offered in evidence. And you have testimony of the defendant as to how that order impacted on him. Is that a correct statement?
Yes.
Why wouldn't State versus McAllister cover that? This reminds me of the old operating after revocation cases where you have to put in either certified copies, admissions, or other competent proof. And as other competent proof, it would have to be reliable documentary proof. Why wouldn't this constitute that?
Well, in the circumstance here, if we assume for a moment that the order should not have been admitted, the copy of the copy, my position is what's left doesn't prove a part of the element that is in question in the first issue. I agree with the Court of Appeals that really all Mr. Smith's testimony proved was he was aware that there was a court in the state of Maine that issued an order that directed him to pay child support, which goes to the other element of the offense. I don't think he provided anything in terms of a basis for which the jury could have concluded that the court in Maine was authorized to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction.
It sounds like you're reading the validity into that issue of competent jurisdiction.
Well, what I'm saying is
if he testifies he's aware that there's an order from Maine, and the issue is whether or not there's an order from a court of competent jurisdiction, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, he argued quite strenuously throughout this litigation that the court in Maine that did issue this order lacked jurisdiction to do so. And the strongest basis for that argument that he raised was that in the state of Maine, under the particular structure of family law, in order to amend a child support order, the only court that can do so is the court that initially entered a child support order. It entertains exclusive, continuous jurisdiction in the matter. And in this case, it did strike me as odd that the initial divorce order was issued in a Waldo County court in the state of Maine, and then some years later there is a child support order that comes out of a different county court in the state of Maine, and it raises some legal eyebrows under those circumstances.
Mr. Donnelly, is it not correct that the court issuing the divorce judgment was a district court and the court that issued the support order was a superior court?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that there's different levels of trial court, if you will, in the state of Maine.
There are.
Is that not important to an analysis of whether or not this was a court of competent jurisdiction?
Under the particular statutory scheme in Maine, it does not as it relates to family matters. It appears to me from my reading of the statutes in the state of Maine, if the district court assumes jurisdiction in a family matter and enters a child support order, they entertain exclusive, continuous jurisdiction in that matter. And they're the only ones who can amend the order that they issued.
But this is not an amendment. You've got a divorce judgment that basically says we're not issuing a support order because Mr. Smith is incarcerated. And now you've got a superior court later issuing a support order. It's not an amendment, is it?
Well, maybe that is something that gets argued. In this particular case, the state took a contrary position at the trial court level on one occasion when Mr. Smith also attacked the jurisdiction of the court to act in Maine when he argued that, that under ERISA, they could not commence a ERISA prosecution for civil enforcement for the first time through a ERISA action. There had to be an existing support order. And the state argued at the trial level that the initial trial court order for the divorce was a support order. So whether it was or wasn't, my instinct is to say, since it, under our definition, it would not be a support order because it doesn't include a specific order to pay a sum. But whether or not it's an order in the state of Maine, I can't tell you.
In the Court of Appeals, did the defendant argue that the Waldo County Superior Court didn't have the authority to issue the order?
My recollection is in the Court of Appeals, whether or not the order that was issued in the state of Maine was authorized, actually authorized by a court of jurisdiction, I don't believe was addressed in the respondent's brief.
So it was more the separate jury question and the authenticity of the document, but not actually the legitimate.
Well, that question was never addressed. I think the position that the respondent took, or that I took in my brief, was that was a question for the jury and one that the trial court took away from the jury, and it's also a question that should always go to the jury, and another court shouldn't take that question away either.
Well, if the jury found that something was if the jury found something was from a court of competent jurisdiction, could this court say it wasn't on appeal?
Well, I don't know if the state could appeal an acquittal if they found it was not a court of
on a conviction.
On a conviction.
I mean, if there were a conviction, wouldn't you be able to argue sort of as a matter of law, a pure question, that this court wasn't competent to issue that order? But wouldn't you be putting us in a position of second-guessing a factual finding of the jury?
I suppose.
Why wouldn't you argue that there's just not sufficient evidence on that element?
That is the position I took in this case, and the Court of Appeals analyzed it that way. If it is an element, then it's a factual determination for the jury to decide, and I believe the court is bound by that.
Even if it's a question of law, and we're using these terms loosely, in cases where foreign law, not other state law, comes into play, I think it's usually a question of fact to be proved to the judge, and you prove it with expert witness.
That certainly would be helpful.
But, I mean, I think that it gets labeled as a question of fact, but it's for the judge.
Well, for instance, in a resisting or obstructing case, the jury is asked to decide whether or not a police officer was operating or working with lawful authority. And that question involves what is traditionally a question of law for the court. Perhaps the issue is whether or not the law officer was making a lawful arrest. In almost every context, that's a question for the court to answer. But in the context of a criminal charge for resisting or obstructing, that's a question for the jury. And if the jury decides that the law officer was acting with lawful authority, that is a finding of fact that I don't believe that the reviewing court will overturn.
Unless there's insufficient evidence.
Correct.
Mr. Donnelly, if I could, I want to touch on the issue of remedy before your time is up. In this case, the Court of Appeals basically held there's a double jeopardy bar ruling in the sufficiency argument that you made. Assuming for sake of argument that we either agree with you that there's an element, or in the alternative that we say that there's an affirmative defense that was presented and you should have been allowed to present the issue to the jury and have the jury properly instructed, the fact that the court kept the evidence away from the jury and didn't instruct, shouldn't that result in a new trial as opposed to a jeopardy bar based on the erroneous rulings of the trial court that impacted on the trial?
Are you asking, assuming that it is an element?
Whether it's an element or whether it's an affirmative defense, either way, the court kept evidence away from the jury, so the jury never heard it, and the court didn't instruct. Why doesn't that go back for a new trial?
Well, I think in the context, if there was other evidence or sufficient evidence in the record, if there was sufficient evidence in the record to suggest that there was a court of competent jurisdiction operating here, then I think the remedy would be a new trial. But in the context of this case, there wasn't sufficient evidence for a jury or for the court.
If there was evidence, why wouldn't then Nader apply in State versus Harvey and it become harmless error?
If there was evidence?
Yeah.
In that context, it may well be harmless error.
But if there wasn't evidence, because it was kept from the jury never hears it, the matter was never fully tried. Why isn't that a new trial as opposed to a sufficiency of the evidence claim? I guess I'm not following how you get to sufficiency of the evidence here.
Well, it just flows from the fact that it's an element that has to be proven to the jury. And ultimately, at the end of this case, the State did not do that. They did not prove to this jury that there was sufficient evidence for which to convict him of this particular offense.
Now, the Court of Appeals revised its opinion, and it made reference to a case, its name escapes me, which indicated that there is proof, even if it's inadmissible bad proof, and that you look at it for inadmissible bad proof. So here, there was proof of the main order. Your position and the Court of Appeals' position is it's not good proof under the statute. But, and again, I'm sorry, I did not read that case, but if the case says what the Court of Appeals says and what I understand Justice Butler is saying, you do have evidence in there. It's not good evidence, according to you, but that made it sufficient, therefore new trial.
My position, to be clear here, is even if the document that remained in the clerk of court's office had been admitted into evidence here, that would not have been proof of the fact that it was an order issued by a court of competent jurisdiction. As Mr. Prey explained, that you cannot tell from the face of the document itself whether or not it was issued by a court of competent jurisdiction. You have to review the
law. So your position is that even if it was certified properly and put in, when it's challenged as being invalid, then you need further evidence.
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly. Rymuth, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Starting with the last topic first, the case that Justice Abramson is referring to is Lockhart versus Nelson, which stands for the proposition that when you review a sufficiency of the evidence question, a reviewing court looks at all the evidence, including inadmissible evidence. And in this case, the worst-case scenario from the State's standpoint is that if error occurred here, it was error that would warrant a new trial. And that's with respect to 2 points. One is the inadmissible court order document would be considered. And on top of that, Mr. Smith's testimony, which includes the following evidence. He testified at trial that he met with a Maine state official and agreed to begin paying child support pursuant to a document that both he and a Superior Court justice signed. He admitted unsuccessfully challenging it through the Maine courts. So there is at least sufficient evidence here that the jurisdiction, if there is a jurisdictional element, this court of competent jurisdiction element, there certainly was proof here of all the evidence, when you look at the entire evidence. So that's the worst-case scenario, harmless.
I guess maybe I'm not stating my question clearly enough. I guess the concern that I have is that we're talking about sufficiency as though the case were fully tried. The defense has raised a challenge, as I understand it, that the court did not properly instruct the jury and properly admit the evidence, therefore asking for a new trial. Is one of the alternatives. By making that request, doesn't that deal with the double jeopardy bar?
I think so. This is the conundrum that I couldn't find a thread for the answer, but it makes common sense, and that is that if there's an element that the trial court takes away from the jury, and it shouldn't have, and then bars evidence on that element so that there's no trial of that element, Should that be a situation where the state should be allowed to retry on a subsequent appellate determination that that was an element?
And you don't have any cases on that
point? I don't have cases that directly address that point. I guess you could have different fact scenarios there, too. You could have a situation where the state is willing, has evidence, and is willing to put it in. The court says, "Don't, you can't put it in because it's not relevant. It's not, not an element." Or you could have a scenario where the state objects that it was an element and refuses to put in any evidence on it. But I'm thinking that you don't have to answer that here if you get to harmless error, which I hope you don't. But if you do, the evidence here was sufficient based on what was there, even if this is an element, and even if even if there's this instructional error.
How do you get to harmless error if not only do you have the court, assuming we say that the jury should have heard the evidence, that the court not only doesn't instruct the jury, but the court keeps evidence from the jury? How can you ever get to a determination as a practical matter, not saying that harmless error doesn't apply, but practically speaking, how can you say that that error would be harmless?
Harmless error? It would have to be that narrow situation that Nader and Gordon talks about, and that is where there's no genuine dispute of fact about that particular element.
But there was a dispute.
Well, this is the argument that we would make, is that there wasn't, in the sense of his testimony was that he went through the courts.
You're just saying that the evidence was insufficient, but there was a dispute.
He
challenged it in Maine, he challenged it here.
I'm saying on the harmless error analysis, in order for us, if you get to harmless error,
right,
in order for us to prevail on harmless error, if this was an element, and there was insufficient instruction on that element, the only way you could find harmless error, as I understand it, under Gordon and Nader, would be if there was no real genuine dispute of fact about satisfaction of that element. And the state's position here is that if a court of competent jurisdiction is an element, that Mr. Smith's testimony here, that he submitted to the jurisdiction of the Maine court, that he challenged it, that it's been not overturned, that even though it isn't the best evidence, perhaps, that it is enough, that there was no real dispute of fact on that point.
In Nader and in Yates, isn't it true that the element was not contested at all? In other words, there was no evidence at all disputing the element, whereas in this case, you're arguing whether the evidence is sufficient to reach that level. I think they're two different things.
Well, you're right. There's a question between sufficiency and a question between whether there's a genuine dispute. And I'm saying both of these are, there was no genuine dispute and there was sufficient evidence. That's the argument in it.
I think there are cases that say, even though the defense alleges error, and may be right, that when you look at the total case, if the evidence is not sufficient, you got a double jeopardy issue. Unfortunately, that's all I remember. But I read it recently, so now I'll go back to one of the databases and see if my recollection is faulty or not. But anyway,
in light of this issue, I'll continue to look, and if I find something in the next few days, I will submit it. And obviously, I couldn't find anything with that exact scenario.
Do you have a very, very, very brief summary that you want to make? You've got almost no rebuttal time, counsel.
I think the summary that I stated at the beginning is what I would reiterate here. Unfortunately, there's this series of alternatives, but that's the first argument on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our argument 03-1698 CR State versus Smith. And the court wishes to thank both Assistant Attorney General Frymuth and Assistant State Public Defender Donnelly for their excellent arguments this morning. They've been very helpful. We'll take a few moments of recess because we have other students who wish to enter the courtroom. So the court's in recess for a few minutes, and we'll be right back.